and that case is the People against Simon Ewing Sue. Counsel, you may set up. And let me say to you that we have read the briefs in this case. We are familiar with the record and the facts and the prior decision that was issued in the case. If that helps you streamline your presentation, then we hope it does, so be it. The yellow light comes on when there are 5 minutes remaining for the appellant to plan on rebuttal if he chooses to do so. I would ask that ladies and gentlemen who are in the audience and counsel turn off cell phones and pagers so that we're not bothered during the argument. And with that request, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Anthony Noble and I represent the appellant Simon Sue. This is an appeal of the district court's denial of post-conviction relief. The district court denied post-conviction relief on two grounds. First, the district court found that Mr. Sue was not denied his right to a direct appeal. And second, the district court found that the petition in which Mr. Sue presented that claim was a successive petition. In the post-conviction proceedings, four separate claims on the denial of a right to appeal were presented. The first was that the court failed to advise Mr. Sue of the deadline to file the appeal. The second was that defense counsel failed to advise Mr. Sue of the deadline to file a direct appeal. The third was that defense counsel disregarded Mr. Sue's instructions to file a direct appeal. And the fourth was that defense counsel failed to consult with Mr. Sue about a direct appeal. On the first claim, the district court's failure to advise Mr. Sue of the deadline to file a direct appeal, the record is clear that the district court did advise Mr. Sue that he had a right to appeal and did advise Mr. Sue that he had the right to counsel to be appointed for that appeal if he was found to be indigent. But the district court did not advise Mr. Sue of the deadline to file that appeal, the 45 deadline pursuant to this court's rules. That wasn't really an issue in the proceedings in the post-conviction case. What the district court decided was that Mr. Sue was not prejudiced by that failure to advise him of the deadline to file the appeal. District court ruled that Mrs. Sue had an appeal anyway, and the district court's referring to the appeal of the denial of the 35A motion, which this court decided prior to this appeal. By reaching
which was treated as a 35C motion as well.
Yes, because there was clarification from this court later on in the Collier case that when you pursue a claim pursuant to Apprendi and Blakely, that it's not actually a 35A motion, it's a 35C motion. But at the time of the proceedings, prior to that appeal and prior to the Collier decision, it was pursued as a 35A motion and a legal sentence. The district court applied the wrong test to determine whether or not Mr. Sue was prejudiced by that failure to advise him of the deadline to file a direct appeal. Because the district court said that, well, he got an appeal anyway, and therefore he wasn't prejudiced. But he didn't get a direct appeal. He got an appeal of the denial of a 35A motion.
Counsel, I appreciate your argument on this point, and I will tell you, I think you're right. I think, at least based on my view as I sit here right now, I think you have a very strong argument on that point. But just for curiosity's sake, what arguments would have been available to Mr. Sue in a direct appeal that were not actually pursued in the prior motion for post-conviction relief?
He could have argued that, he could have challenged the propriety of the Rule 11 advisement, of the plea agreement, any technical problems with the complaint and the information, or the proceedings leading to the entry of the plea agreement, and any other deficiencies or defects that he could have found with the sentence. But that was denied by having this limited appeal on the 35A. Also, he was denied the actual procedure of having a direct appeal. Having an appellate attorney appointed to the case to look at the the record and determine whether there are any other non-meritorious claims that could have been pursued. It was denied this court reviewing the record if appellate counsel decided that there were no meritorious issues to pursue. He was denied the whole proceeding, not specifically any claims that could be pursued on appeal, but the actual proceeding itself. And I think that that's what's important in this case, is that he was denied that proceeding by the district court's failure to advise him of the deadline. So the district court applied the wrong test for prejudice. Instead of saying that, well, you know, he had an appeal anyway, what the district court should have done is determined whether or not Mr. Sue had independent knowledge of that deadline to appeal. And one thing that was established during the evidentiary hearing in the post-conviction proceedings was that nobody told him that he had 45 days to file a direct appeal. None of the three attorneys that represented him during that period advised him that he had a 45-day deadline to file that direct appeal. So he was prejudiced by the district court's failure to advise him of that 45-day deadline to file a direct appeal. The second claim that was pursued in the post-conviction proceedings was defense counsel's failure to advise Mr. Sue of the deadline to file a direct appeal. Mr. Sue testified that nobody advised him of the 45-day deadline. Defense counsel testified that they had no recollection of advising him. The district court, however, never actually made a decision about whether or not he was advised of the 45-day deadline. The district court actually said, and I quote, "You know, perhaps not, but the appeal was taken anyway." So the district court again is referring to this appeal of the denial of the 35A motion, assuming that that's sufficient to satisfy Mr. Sue's right to a direct appeal. Now, the correct test of prejudice for that claim is, you know, whether there was a reasonable probability that the defendant would have timely appealed but for counsel's deficient performance. So the district court never addressed that test in these post-conviction proceedings. And I think it's clear that if the district court had addressed whether or not Mr. Sue would have timely appealed, that the court would have concluded that he would. As soon as Mr. Sue entered the plea agreement in this case, he conferred with independent counsel to determine whether there were any grounds to withdraw that plea. He was concerned about what he had done. He was concerned about the sentence. He was concerned about his appellate rights. He asked, it was Jim Castle who was appointed to advise him on withdrawing the plea agreement. And he specifically asked about, you know, do I still have any rights to appeal if I don't like the sentence that I get? None of this is in dispute. When he was sentenced, the judge made a finding that he was upset by the sentence and that he did want to pursue some kind of remedy to challenge the sentence.
It's clear, however, that if you were going to just complain about the court's discretionary decision to impose this sentence, that that argument would be foreclosed by the statute. Is that correct?
The propriety of the sentence,
yes.
Your Honor. Yes, that's correct. What wouldn't be foreclosed would be challenging the constitutionality of the sentence. That's not foreclosed by 18.1409. So there would still be that possibility to appeal the sentence under Blakely and Apprendi.
But that claim actually was raised in the 35C.
That's correct, Your Honor. And this court determined that there was no violation of Apprendi.
So you see my difficulty, because it seems that the actual practical claims, the claims that could be brought as a practical matter, either were brought or were foreclosed by statute.
Yes, Your Honor, but it was brought within the context of an appeal of a denial of a Rule 35A. And you can see that the prejudice that Mr. Sue suffered by having to pursue this procedure rather than a direct appeal, because his co-defendant, Jonathan Matheny, who was proceeding in a different case, but for the same charges, he entered an almost identical plea to Mr. Sue, was given a very similar sentence to Mr. Sue. He was represented by the public defender. The public defender filed a direct appeal, and his sentence was vacated because it violated Apprendi and Blakely.
Were they sentenced in the same time frame, which is to say before the announcement of Blakely?
Yes, Your Honor, they were. But because John Matheny was pursuing on direct appeal, he got the benefit of Blakely, whereas Mr. Sue didn't get that benefit because he wasn't on direct appeal. He was on an appeal of a denial of a 35A, so Blakely wasn't applied retroactively to Mr. Sue's sentence.
Did he get the benefit of Blakely, or did he get the benefit of Allen?
Well, Mr. Sue didn't get a benefit of Allen because...
Well, I'm Mr. Matheny.
Oh, no. Mr. Matheny, I believe, got the benefit of Blakely because he was on direct appeal, so therefore Blakely applied retroactively to his sentence, whereas it didn't apply retroactively to Mr. Sue's sentence. So that's why, you know, this is such a big deal to Mr. Sue. That's why...
Well, let me ask you, so just to understand the timing of this is that Mr. Sue was sentenced in August of 2003, and then Blakely was decided in July of 2004?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so it's your argument then that his case would have still been on appeal when Blakely...
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. And therefore he would have got the benefit of Blakely and his sentence would have been vacated because it is a violation of Apprendi and Blakely, and he would have gone... he would have been remanded for a resentencing hearing and possibly get some kind of benefit because John Matheny, who this particular district judge always believed was the killer of the two grandparents, I think he got at least some kind of reduction in his sentence. Whereas Mr. Sue, who, you know, wasn't involved in the killing, he was in Canada at the time, you know, developed an exemplary prison record during that time, may have got a much greater reduction in sentence. So the district court applied the wrong prejudice test to that claim. The third claim was that defense counsel disregarded Mr. Sue's instructions to file an appeal. Again, the district court didn't make any finding on this. Mr. Sue testified that he told his attorneys to appeal. They had no recollection of him giving that instruction. The district court didn't make a finding on whether or not that happened. Instead, the district court said that that was a strategic decision not to appeal. Now, we know from this court's opinion in People v. Long that there's no strategy involved in disregarding an instruction to appeal. So that ruling was clearly incorrect. The fourth claim was that defense counsel failed to consult with Mr. Sue about his right to an appeal. This duty to consult about an appeal was triggered in this case by the fact that a rational defendant in Mr. Sue's shoes would have wanted to appeal, and this particular defendant, Mr. Sue, would have wanted to appeal. And again, the record demonstrates that Mr. Sue wasn't happy with any of these proceedings. He was challenging everything, the plea, the sentence. He filed a slew of pro se motions at that time. So it's clear that he would have wanted to appeal if he had known of the timeline, the proper procedures, and he'd been consulted about that. And I quickly want to address the other ground for denial of the post-conviction motion, which was the successive petition finding. A post-conviction claim can be dismissed for two reasons under the successive petition part of Rule 35C. One is that the claim was raised and ruled upon in a prior appeal or post-conviction proceeding, and the other is that it could have been raised in a prior appeal or post-conviction proceeding. First, it's clear that this claim wasn't raised in a prior appeal or post-conviction proceeding. The claim that we presented in the post-conviction proceedings was a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. The claim in the prior appeal and the 35A post-conviction proceedings was an illegal sentence in violation of Apprendi and Blakely. So that is pretty clear that it wasn't raised in the prior appeal or post-conviction proceeding. Now, whether it could not have been raised is a slightly more difficult question. What happened here was that there was a hearing set for the Rule 35A motion. And at the end of that hearing, the court denied the 35A motion, and defense counsel said, Your Honor, we have other 35 claims to pursue. And the judge said, well, the way to do that is file a notice of appeal, ask the court for a remand, and then pursue the 35C claims on remand. So defense counsel did exactly that, filed a notice of appeal, asked for a remand, but this court denied the motion for a limited remand. So Mr. Sue could not have raised that these 35C claims in a prior appeal or post-conviction proceeding.
Did Mr. Sue identify what those other 35C claims were, either to the trial court or in the motion for limited remand to this court?
Not specifically, Your Honor, although there was a motion filed by James Castle at some point prior to that hearing in which he presented the Apprendi-Blakely claim, and then he indicated to the court that he needed further time to review the other claims because he'd received 12 banker's boxes of discovery and other documents to review. So the court was aware that there were other claims, but none of them were specifically identified. And this claim that we pursued in the post-conviction proceedings, the denial of a direct appeal, was not specifically identified prior to the filing of the motion that was ruled to be successive. So what I'm asking the court to do is vacate the order denying post-conviction relief and remand this case to the district court with instructions to vacate and reinstate the sentence, which would trigger a new 45-day period for Mr. Sue to file a notice of appeal so he gets his direct appeal.
Counsel, on that point, I'm aware that some courts have used that remedy. And what case do you rely on for the proposition that that is the appropriate remedy to use here?
The first case, Your Honor, would be this court's opinion in People versus Long. And if that's not good enough, I have a United States Supreme Court opinion, Roe versus Flores-Ortega.
Because I recall that in People against Long, that remedy may have been initially announced, but then I think on petition for rehearing, wasn't that opinion amended so that it's clear that the appropriate remedy is to just get an order of the district court reflecting that there has been ineffective assistance of counsel and to combine that order with a motion to this court for leave to file a late appeal under Rule 2?
I suppose that would have the same effect, Your Honor. When you look at the federal circuits and other opinions from other jurisdictions, it seems to be quite consistent that what they've been doing is vacating and reinstating the sentence.
What makes that problematic, it seems to me, is that it may trigger a whole new batch of sentencing law. But maybe it's not a problem here. Maybe it doesn't make any practical difference here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Noble.
That works too. Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people in this matter. I would like to start off by discussing the successive issue. The trial court did deny the defendant's motion on the basis that it was successive of his earlier 35C motion that he filed in 2004. And that's correct. First of all, it was a 35C motion that he filed. The fact that he raised an Apprendi claim does not transfer it to a 35A. Mr. Noble points out that the Collier case came out in 2006, and in that case it specifically said Apprendi and Blakely claims fall under 35C, not under 35A. However, there was already case law on that, specifically concerning Apprendi claims. And I apologize, this wasn't in the briefs, but it's more of a surreply. So I'd like to direct this court's attention to People versus Gardner at 55 P3rd 231, a 2002 case from this court in which it holds that Apprendi claims are cognizant under 35C. So we do have a prior 35C post-conviction motion. The defendant could have raised this ineffective assistance of counsel claim at the time that he filed that motion in 2004. The time for direct appeal had already passed. He was already aware of all of the facts that went into this motion. And under Prim P 35C 37, It holds that the court shall deny any claim that could have been presented or brought in a previous post-conviction proceeding. And that language is shall. That language is mandatory. This court does not have discretion to consider the claims raised here because they could have been raised in that earlier post-conviction motion.
Ms. Berman, let me ask you, does it make any difference that the trial court below told the defendant we'll wait on these and then ask for a limited remand and then we'll entertain the remaining issues?
I don't believe it does matter. That had happened at the point that he had already filed for an appeal of the earlier post-conviction motion. And he had, I'm not exactly sure of the amount of time, but between the motion and the hearing and the time in which he appealed that earlier motion, he had a lot of time in which to raise these claims. At least at the hearing, he was represented by counsel, and so he had the benefit of counsel to raise those claims as well. And I think that when you look at the purpose of CRIMP 35C37, or at least what I believe to be the purpose, which would be, to provide judicial economy and also to provide finality to the proceedings, it doesn't make sense that somebody who waits until the case is already on appeal and then tries to raise these claims would get the benefit of that when this rule is in place at that time.
According to your analysis, the time to have added those claims was when the original motion was filed.
Yes.
Having raised what is in effect a 35C claim in this motion, however captioned, one could have brought.
Exactly. You look to the substance. And I think that it would have been okay once he got counsel for counsel to seek to amend. And if counsel truly believed we have a 35A motion here only, counsel could have amended it to add 35C claims. In fact, if you look at the record, for the limited amount of time that Mr. Castle represented the defendant in post-conviction, I believe he tried to do that to the defendant's 35B motion. He was going to add 35A and 35C claims. However, he withdrew from the case before that could be done. So I would ask this court to find that the motion is successive and to agree with the district court on that.
Indeed, the court granted the motion to amend that Mr. Castle had filed.
It did. And that 35B motion, first of all, again, was never amended. And second of all, was the defendant abandoned it. I'm afraid I don't remember the exact reasoning, but he abandoned the 35B motion. That was also supposed to go to hearing, and it didn't. If this court decides to look at the merits of the defendant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the court should agree with the district court that the defendant failed to prove ineffective assistance of counsel for counsel's failure to file a notice of appeal on his behalf. Actually, first of all, I'd like to address counsel's claims on the trial court's advisement. It's uncontested here that the trial court did in fact advise the defendant of his right to appeal. It is also uncontested that the trial court did not advise him of the 45-day window within which to appeal. Now, whether that is error is uncertain, especially given the fact that at the time of the sentencing in 2003, the current version of the advisement that's supposed to be given, which is provided in CRIMP 32C, was not in existence at that time. And that is the advisement that the defendant is relying on. But in fact, an earlier version of CRIMP 32C was in place. And that version is recognized in the Bosflug case. I apologize if I've mispronounced that, but a 2004 case of this court. And I'm going to read what that version of 32C is. Except in cases where judgment of conviction has been entered following a plea of guilty or nolo contendere, the court shall, after passing sentence, inform the defendant of his right to seek review of his conviction. And what we get from that language is, first of all, there's an exception in the case of a guilty plea, like the defendant had, so that this advisement may need not be given two defendants who plead guilty, and the Boesflug court determined it was uncertain if it in fact implied in those cases. And secondly, there's nothing about in advising the defendant of the time limits for an appeal. It simply says the court shall, after passing sentence, inform the defendant of his right to seek review of his conviction. It does go on to say the court shall, after passing sentence, inform the defendant of his rights concerning appellate review of his sentence. So it does say that the court needs to advise the defendant of his rights to appeal the conviction and to appeal the sentence, but it doesn't give information that the court needs to tell him of the time limits for doing so. I would argue that the cases cited by Mr. Noble, none of them say that the failure to advise of the 45-day time limit in of itself is error. They simply say that a failure to advise of the right to appeal is error. And here it's uncontested.
So your argument would be that the absence of this information in the advisement by the district court does not support a standalone claim that the court erred.
Correct.
But you'll agree that it's relevant in terms of determining the potential prejudice of counsel's failure to provide the advice. In other words,
it can be a relevant factor, yes.
Yeah, because it wasn't rendered harmless by the court's own advisement.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It would be relevant for that. Moving on to counsel's own advice, the trial court found, first of all, the trial court found that we did have advice of his right to appeal, but again, it was uncontested that, you know, counsel did not advise him of the 45-day time limit. And as far as the record is concerned, there's definitely nothing affirmative showing that they did. So then we move on to the analysis set forth in Roe versus Flores-Ortega. The first question in determining whether there was deficient performance by counsel is whether counsel specifically instructed, or I'm sorry, whether the defendant specifically instructed counsel to file a direct appeal. Here the trial court found that the defendant did not, and that finding is supported in the record and therefore should be affirmed by this court. Even though the defendant testified that he told counsel immediately after sentencing, when being taken away by the sheriffs, he told them, "I want you to do something about this. I want an appeal." First of all, even from his own testimony, he admitted that he only whispered it to one of his attorneys, Ms. Kaufman, and he was not sure that the other attorney, Mr. Levinson, heard him. And so even from his own testimony, I don't really know that you get affirmative evidence that counsel heard him specifically instruct them to appeal.
Well, Ms. Berman, did the court make any findings as to what happened, or did the court just skip and say, well, it doesn't matter because it's a strategy decision?
I think that the court found that the court didn't go into the specific facts of that incident. I think the court just in general said he didn't specifically instruct. And I think the court adopted Ms. Kaufman's testimony that even if there's mention of the word appeal, it doesn't necessarily mean direct appeal, file a notice of direct appeal. And I think there's case authority for that in Flores-Ortega itself, which if you look at that case for how it determines prejudice, if you move ahead and its determination of prejudice, it says that one of the relevant factors is whether the defendant promptly expressed a desire to appeal. So it's making a distinction between expressing a desire to appeal and specifically instructing to appeal, because that court holds that if the defendant specifically instructed to appeal and counsel ignores that, then you have deficient performance, then you have ineffective assistance. And so the case law makes that distinction. So here, even if there was an expression of wanting to appeal, first of all, that's not enough. Second of all, that kind of goes to all of the post-conviction remedies that were possible. I mean, here the defendant had a really good 35B claim to be made, and he didn't really have much of a direct appeal at all. You know, he pled guilty. There was a stipulated sentence. So under 18.1409, he couldn't, as you pointed out, he couldn't appeal the propriety of the sentence. He couldn't appeal the conviction itself. it was very limited, the things that he could appeal. So we don't...
With the benefit of hindsight, the Blakely argument on direct appeal would be in a noticeably different posture and one more favorable to Mr. Sue.
It would, but under ineffective assistance law, we don't look through the benefit of hindsight. We look at counsel's performance at the time in which they represented the defendant. Here we didn't have Blakely, and under Apprendi, the defendant didn't have recourse. It would have been a frivolous claim along with, I don't know that he specifies along what other claims he would have raised, but I don't think he had non-frivolous claims to raise in this case. My time's almost up. The trial court also found that the counsel did consult with the defendant, which is another consideration in determining whether they gave ineffective assistance. And I think that's supported in the record, in that counsel said, we discussed the post-conviction remedies, we discussed the 35B, we discussed everything generally in order to try to figure out what was the best course of action. And so you get the trial court's findings that they discussed avenues of appeal in the general sense, avenues to pursue remedies were discussed and were chosen or not chosen. Even if it's determined that counsel did not sufficiently consult with the defendant about the advantages and disadvantages of appealing, counsel had no constitutional duty to do so here. A rational defendant in the defendant's position in this case would not have wanted to directly appeal. Again, the issues for which he could directly appeal were so very limited, and he had a good avenue under this 35B motion that would have been to his benefit to raise immediately in order to get that change sentence, to get a reduced sentence. You know, had he pursued a claim challenging the aggravation of the sentence, even if he had won, the trial court could simply have stacked his sentences and gotten the same amount of time. It could have just given him consecutive sentencing instead and still given him a 53-year sentence. So having been advised of that, a defendant in the defendant's place would not have wanted to directly appeal, would have rather pursued the Crimby 35B claim pursued here.
Counsel, now all of this goes to inform the deficient performance prong of Strickland.
Yes, and a bit the prejudice prong, which they do have a similar analysis.
You will concede, I hope, that Mr. Noble has an excellent point on the court's analysis for prejudice. In other words, if we determine that counsel erred in failing to file an appeal, it's not good enough to say, well, we can't at this point find a meritorious claim. If he's been deprived of the right of appeal, that's enough, right?
Only if he specifically instructed them to file an appeal. If he did not specifically instruct them to file an appeal, then deficient performance in failing to consult with him only prejudices him if he can show a reasonable possibility that he would have appealed but for that deficient performance. And we don't have that here. And that's kind of where you get the same analysis in terms of looking at, were there non-frivolous claims? You know, did the defendant express a desire to appeal? I see that my time is up, so I'd ask that this court affirm the trial court's order.
Thank you, Ms. Berman. Now, thank you again, Mr. Noble. Counsel, your arguments today were excellent, and I think they were helpful to us, and we thank you for that. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our docket for this afternoon, and the bailiff may announce a recess.
All rise.